What kind of a threat really is artificial intelligence? Elon Musk, a tremendous entrepreneur, said this: AI is humanity's biggest existential threat. Is that really true? We're going to talk about that right now in this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our guest is Dr. Robert J. Marks. He's a professor at Baylor University, and if you ever saw the movie Expelled with Ben Stein, Robert Marks was there in the movie. His website, by the way, is called evoinfo.org. And Dr. Marks, it's so great to talk with you. And as a starting point, what do you teach at Baylor?
Well, right now I teach only graduate courses. I teach a course in information theory, teach a course in multidimensional signal processing, which I'm sure everybody will be excited about. I teach a course in stochastic processes, random processes, noise, probability, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And I teach really interesting things to people that find them interesting.
All right. Now, Stephen Hawking, using another quote here about artificial intelligence, he said that the development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race. What do you say in response to that and also the Elon Musk quote from earlier?
Well, I think it's actually hyperbole. And I think that people who say this sort of thing need to go back to the fundamentals and understand what computers can't and can do. And if they understood that, I don't think that they would be making statements of this sort. Certainly, we see a lot of cool things happening with artificial intelligence, with computers beating the world champion at Go and winning at Jeopardy and winning at chess and all of this other sort of thing. But extrapolating that is really, it's difficult, and I think that's what they're doing. Niels Bohr, who was, one of the founders of quantum theory, said, prediction is very dangerous, especially if it's about the future.
Yeah.
And if you go back, and you look at the experts in different fields making predictions about the future,
Yeah. You
find out that they actually look like kind of fools. And I always say if you have somebody at the top that says something, it's either the wisdom of expertise or the babbling of a fool. Now, I don't want to call Elon Musk or Stephen Hawking fools. Clearly, they have accelerated in their fields, and they're doing great and wonderful things. But in this, they're out of line.
Huh. Well, okay, Bill Gates, another clear expert, of course. He said, I don't understand why some people are not concerned about AI. Artificial intelligence. What is the concern at risk? Something like out of that movie 2001: A Space Odyssey, where the computer was it named HAL or something overpowers the humans and manages to make decisions and then literally cuts them off and with catastrophic results, as I recall.
Well, I actually think HAL might be an achievable sort of AI, but I think there it was a big programming error because they actually put the mission above that of the lives of the crew.
Mm.
So that violated one of Isaac Asimov's rules in iRobot, that you can't hurt another human being.
What is iRobot?
Oh, iRobot was, 1960s, I believe, novel that was written by the great science fiction writer at the time, Isaac Asimov. It was made into a movie starring the guy from, Will somebody. And it was released, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. So it's a short story, and it's a movie. But we have all. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, what I don't understand is, okay, just because Isaac Asimov made a rule. I mean, I know of Isaac Asimov's worldview in the sense that he was definitely anti-God, and
yes, he was.
If you were to sit down and talk with him about the Ten Commandments, he'd probably say, hey, you know, those are out of date, we need, you know, new things. But anybody can make any rules they want to. Who's to say that those rules are binding? And so even if he made rules for his novel iRobot, how would that be binding for artificial intelligence today? If that makes
sense.
Well,
here's the situation. Anytime there's the introduction of new technology, it has to be managed. My goodness, when we had the automobile coming out, we had to put rules on that automobile so it wouldn't be dangerous.
Yeah.
Same thing with the introduction with electricity. We had to be very careful in making sure that electricity wasn't going to hurt people. And Thomas Edison actually didn't like the alternating current. He was going around trying to scare people like people are being scared about AI today, and he went to different state fairs and electrocuted animals to show that electricity wasn't safe, at least the type that Tesla was using. He said his Edison's type was okay. He even electrocuted an elephant, for goodness sakes.
What, was he using DC?
And then he was using AC because Edison was a proponent of DC.
Right. Okay.
So there was this fight going back and forth. So my point is anytime there's introduction of a new technology, it does have to be managed. And AI is going to have incredible implications in our society. There's no doubt about it. But the question is, how is it going to be managed? I mean, we see it today. Even with computers, we have hacking. We have totally lost our privacy. I don't think anybody has any privacy anymore. Yet, my goodness, we have all of the information of the world at our fingertips right now. So that's the advantage. And the advantages, if properly managed, are going to outweigh the disadvantages.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, I have to confess something. For the longest time, I held off on getting a smartphone. And then after I got it, it was like, why didn't I do this earlier? This doesn't make sense. But I would see reports on the news about, if somebody bumps into you and they have you have your smartphone, they can literally take the information somehow from your credit cards and then, charge up bills and so forth. In other words, they could somehow steal your identity and your credit card information, all these kind of bad case scenarios. But like you say, the good outweighs the bad.
Well, it has to, and you do need rules for that. But I think even more fundamentally, the concerns that the people you quoted have are based on a non-understanding of the basics of computer science. And the idea that a computer will never be creative, it will never have consciousness, it will never have understanding. It only does what you tell it to do. And if you go back to the invention of the computer back in the 1930s, a guy named Alan Turing, who was also instrumental in the solving of the Enigma code, the Nazi Enigma code, he is, more importantly, the father of computer science. He invented the computer. And his first computer has become called the Turing machine. And machines that we have today do nothing more than Turing's original machine. Now, Turing's machine, which had a little tape and you could give it commands and programs and was write and read and all of that stuff, Turing's machine would take a heck of a lot longer than the machines we have today. But there is taught in computer science something called the Church-Turing thesis, that today's computers, anything you can do on today's computers, you could do on Turing's original machine. And this is important because we can go back now and we can look at Turing's original machine and we can look at its limitations and find out what it can do and what it can't do and apply it to today's computers, which are clearly thousands, millions, billions times faster than anything Turing could think of. But still, they suffered the same limitations.
By the way, since you mentioned that Turing is the father of computers, did Blaise Pascal and Charles Babbage, did they play some sort of prior role, grandfathers of the computers, if you will?
Absolutely, Blaise Pascal, who's a good friend of mine.
Through his writings, he's tremendous.
An incredibly strong Christian. I was really amazed when I found out here at Baylor at Truett Seminary they actually studied Blaise Pascal's Penzace and some of his other works, and I thought, wow, this guy really did a lot, because we study him here in electrical engineering quite a bit also. Hmm. But Pascal invented a computer, but it was basically a mechanical calculator. And Babbage's original machine was mechanical, and you turned the crank and it popped out things. But the person that popularized it and the person that came up with the basic idea that we use today was Alan Turing.
Okay, now this is on the kind of gross side, but you see these stories every once in a while that some people are trying to get into have sex with robots. You see stories about robots being invented to serve as butlers, or they're going to have robots serve in fast food places, replacing human beings, and all this kind of stuff. But you're saying that none of these entities will ever have a soul, if you will.
they never will have a soul. They will never have an understanding of what they do. They will never have a consciousness. Computers can only do things which are called algorithmic. And if it's not algorithmic, then it is non-computable. Algorithmic is a fancy word for recipe. You have to give the computer step-by-step instructions on doing something, just like a recipe in baking a cake. You need your eggs, you need your flour, and you mix them all up and you put them in an oven. So you have a sequence of events that you follow. And computers are exactly that sort of thing. Now, the question is, are there things which are non-algorithmic that are non-computable? Turing actually showed this back in the 1930s, that there are things indisputably, mathematically provable that are not computable. Now, today, I would maintain, and there's other people a lot smarter than me, like Roger Penrose, who maintained that the ability of the human mind is above and beyond the computer, and we can do things that are not computable. In other words, we can do things that are not written out in an algorithm. So we are not computers. We are above and beyond the computers. We might have computers' aspects in us, but our creativity, our understanding, and our consciousness are above and beyond all of that, I would maintain.
I remember reading about it was just a story. I didn't read the actual novel. Somebody created a program by which a computer created a novel. Never read the book. Never, you know, I don't know anything about it, but are you familiar with that story?
I am. And I tell you, if you read these, there's something called citation bluffing. And this is written by well-meaning journalists who are trying to get attention to their work. And they say, computer writes novel, computer writes broad play or something like that.
Yeah.
But if you go and you actually watch it and you, actually the actors kind of make it look good. But heck, they were doing this back in 1961. And even today, the plays that you look at, if you go back and read the transcripts, they're terrible. Not the transcripts. What's the word I want?
The playwright
the script.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you read the script, you find out that you get phrases like this, and this is from a recent play that I watched that was written by the computer. It says something like, "John laid down. He stood up. He took the shotgun off the wall. He put it in his mouth. He looked out the window and saw himself." Just a sequence after sequence of totally uncorrelated garbage. Now,
yeah.
Can they get it better? Yeah, I think they can probably get it better. But are they ever going to be talked about as creative? No. Creativity means abandoning the status quo. So therefore, you can't look at your stored data and come up with something creative. You need something above and beyond that. And all the great creative people in the world look above and beyond their experience to do creative things.
Isn't that neat? When I was at Wheaton Graduate School in the late 1970s, I remember they said one time in one of the classes, I don't remember which particular class, but they were talking about how they were using, it was in the early days of trying to use a computer for translation of the Bible, and in a version from English into the Russian, the verse that says, "The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak," came out as the vodka is good, but the meat is bad.
Yeah. So there are, but I think they can get better and better and better at that. And
yeah.
You know, someday the question is, do you think you could sit down and actually write an algorithm, a step-by-step procedure for translating and doing it accurately? I think if you had enough time and you haven't had enough energy, you might be able to do something like that. But that's a very specific task, and computers are very good at that sort of thing.
Now, I once had a record in my possession which was computer-based music. It was the same thing. A computer had composed this music. And when I listened to it, it was horrible. I mean, it was just very atonal. It's kind of like some of the music today.
Yes.
No and comment.
Some of the work of, like, Schoenberg, for example, with this just terrible
yeah.
music. And the appeal of Schoenberg, I believe, is the mathematics, not the sound.
Hmm.
But here's the thing. How do they teach these computers to do music? I had a friend back in 1990, Russ Eberhardt. He's with, I think, Indiana University or Purdue University right now. But he wrote a program to write music. And what he did is he trained with a bunch of existing tunes. So his music was a result of concatenating the results of previous contributions.
Right.
So I would maintain that there's nothing original in that.
Yeah.
And if you go back and you look at the revolution in music, where I don't know that much about it, but I know that Beethoven came about and he began to use more dissonant chords. And that was a big deal back then because that was something which was incredibly creative. Nobody could have written a Beethoven symphony using programming based on Mozart and Bach. It was just the next step in creativity.
Right, right. And that makes sense. Okay, so at the bottom line is there's really nothing to worry about AI. If anything, it's something helpful for us as a tool. Thank you so much for being with us. People can get more information at evoinfo.org. That's EVOINFO. We've been talking with Dr. Robert J. Marks of Baylor University, also of the Discovery Institute. Thank you so much, Dr. Marks, for being with us.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Newcomb.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
God bless you now. All right, bye-bye.